as such. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me? Is that? I think we'll be fine. Welcome to the side event on the role of forensic and medical sciences in the investigation and prevention of torture and other forms of ill treatment. Yes, please welcome. Just join us. We're just about to get started. Please just take a seat. I realize that the third committee meeting had gone over time, so people are still pouring in, but you know, feel free to just join. As you know, the Special Rapporteur on Torture presented his report to the General Assembly on this important issue yesterday. As you also know, torture still persists in over 100 countries worldwide, despite the pledge to the absolute prohibition on torture. And the UN Convention Against Torture is very clear on the obligation of states to fully investigate any act of torture, irrespective of whether has been a complaint or not. But how do we do this in practice? How do we make sure that systems are in place, that all forms of torture are detected, that they're properly investigated, that the perpetrators are held to account, and the victims receive redress? And what role can forensic science, and especially forensic medical science, play in this endeavor? These are some of the questions we'll be looking at today. I'm very pleased that we have such an eminent panel with us to discuss these questions. Welcome, Juan Mendes, Special Rapporteur on Torture. Welcome, Sir Nigel Rodley. And welcome, Dr. Steen Holger Hansen. My name is Miriam Reventlo. I am working with the International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims, and I will be your moderator for today. I am also very pleased that our sponsors are with us today. His Excellency Mr. Erik Larsson, the Deputy Permanent Representative of Denmark to the United Nations, and His Excellency Mr. Olivier Zender, the Deputy Permanent Representative of Switzerland to the United Nations. Before we get started, I just want to mention two practicalities. The one is that this event is being webcasted. It's a live webcast, the UN webcast. You probably all are familiar with that. And that we will not have translation of the event today. So primarily it will be in English. However, if there are language issues, maybe just indicate that, and I'm sure we can work it out. So without further ado, I will invite the state representatives for their opening remarks. Mr. Larsson, you have the word.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Miriam. It really is a pleasure for me to be here today for this side event, and I'm happy to welcome the Special Rapporteur, Mr. Mendes, with whom we have an excellent cooperation. We are really ready to listen to you, and we are ready to listen to your panel today. We are particularly interested in learning more about your proposed investigative authority, which is a mechanism guaranteed to deliver independent, efficient, effective investigations of allegations of torture. I'm pleased that we have such a strong panel of experts. It's a technical, it's a complicated topic, so we really need your help to understand the importance of the forensic science in the fight against torture and ill treatment, and also of establishing standards for the effective use of forensic evidence in legal investigations. So Nigel Rodley and Mr. Steen Holger Hansen, we look forward very much to hearing from you today. Knowing the quality of the work done by the International Rehabilitation Council of Torture Victims, which Denmark has long supported, and which is one of the organizations behind the Istanbul Protocol, I hope that you, Miriam, will be able to tell us more about the important tool for effective investigation and documentation of torture, including on progress of its recognition and application. Denmark, for many years, has been a strong supporter of the fight against torture. Actually, this year, we have joined forces with Chile, Ghana, Indonesia, Morocco, and launched what we call the Convention Against Torture Initiative, which is a 10-year initiative seeking to achieve universal ratification and improved implementation, which is very much on our agenda today, of the Convention Against Torture. We also, through this initiative, have a group of friends and currently 11 governments and 3 non-government members. And that includes 2 of our co-sponsors here today, Mr. Mendes and Switzerland. And I must say that we hope, of course, many more will share our vision and will join the group. Yesterday here at the UN, we held a side event on the Convention Against Torture Initiative, where we discussed obstacles to ratification and implementation of the Convention Against Torture, and also ways to overcome them and ways forward for the initiative were suggested to us, which we were very happy about. The lack of forensic and medical personnel and the need for training of these could very well prevent a state from better implementation of the conventions. So, the Convention Against Torture celebrates its 30th anniversary this year, and we believe it is as important as when it was adopted in 1984. Building on Article 5 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which clearly states that, quote, no one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, unquote, the Convention establishes that states have a responsibility to actively prevent torture and to promptly and impartially investigate any case where there is a reasonable ground to believe that an act of torture has been committed. It also establishes states' obligation to ensure any victim of torture redress and compensation, including rehabilitation. Forensic and medical sciences are indeed key to implementing these provisions, and we need to raise awareness of this. The Danish member of the Committee Against Torture, Mr. Jens Mudvig, recently said that, and I quote, documentation of torture is maybe the most important pathway to ending impunity and preventing torture, so effective and credible documentation methods are extremely important in this fight, unquote. So we look forward to hearing more about these methods today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Like my Danish colleague, I would like to thank the Special Rapporteur on Torture and other Cruel, Inhuman and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, Professor Juan Mendez, for taking the initiative of convening the side event and on his strong dedication to the accomplishment of his mandate. The fight against torture has been a traditional priority of our Swiss human rights policy. And in spite of its non-derogable nature, the prohibition of torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatments or punishment is far from being a reality in many places of the world, as Mrs. Miriam Reventlow underlined in her introductory remarks. Switzerland is committed to engage towards the eradication of torture through a variety of means, be it by supporting the work of relevant human rights mechanisms, in particular the Special Rapporteur, by engaging in UN fora to strengthen the international legal framework, by supporting civil society organizations engaged on this issue, by fueling the international political mobilization against torture, and by actively contributing to the development of new strategies to tackle the persistence of acts of torture and other ill treatment wherever they happen. And on that latter point, we took advantage of our presidency, of our chairmanship of the OSCE to focus also on the issue of torture within the OSCE area. This year, a valuable report of the Special Rapporteur and today's topic of discussion highlights many core issues that we have been confronted with in our work in these different tracks. The fact that the eradication of torture is first and foremost a matter of political will, beyond the often heard complaint for insufficient resources, the absolute key nature or sufficient medical follow-up and documentation of cases to protect detainees from torture and other ill treatment, the absolute necessity of the independence of experts working on torture allegations, in particular as far as forensic medicine is concerned, a necessity that is too seldom met. On a more personal level, I still remember quite vividly the presentation made by an ICRC doctor about 20 years ago, we called him the torturologue, who told us, well, don't focus too much on the physical consequences of torture, look at the psychological effects, which are much more difficult to measure. This said, I would like to thank Professor Mendez and Sir Nigel Rodley, the chair of the Human Rights Committee, as well as Mr. Hansen of the University of Copenhagen and Mrs. Reventlow from IRCT for coming together today to discuss this important issue in the fight against impunity. I thank you for the attention.
Thank you very much. I will now introduce your panel to you, and I just also realized, because a representative from Denmark mentioned it's the 30th anniversary of the UN Convention Against Torture. At the same time, it's actually the 15th anniversary also of the Istanbul Protocol this year, as one of the crucial tools to document torture. So it's probably very timely to take stock and discuss this very important issue. With regard to methodology, each panelist will give a presentation, his remarks to the Special Rapporteur's report and the findings. After that, we will have a panel discussion, and then I will open the floor for questions, so you're very welcome to engage at that point. The first panelist will be the Special Rapporteur on Torture himself, Professor Juan Mendes. He's an Argentinian lawyer. In his work in Argentina defending human rights activists, he became a target himself, was tortured himself, subsequently entered into a very dedicated career of defending human rights, particularly in the inter-American system. He has held very eminent positions as the director of the Inter-American Institute for Human Rights, president of the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, special advisor to the International Criminal Court, and now since 2010, the position of the UN Special Rapporteur for Torture and Other Forms of Ill Treatment. After that, we will hear from Sir Nigel Rudley, an eminent human rights lawyer and law professor from the United Kingdom with an equally long dedicated career in human rights. You are, as was said already before, member of the Human Rights Committee. You're also commissioner of the International Commission of Jurists. You've been heading the Human Rights Center at the University of Essex, our trustee of Freedom from Torture, founder of InterRights, and at least you were the UN Special Rapporteur for Torture during the time the Istanbul Protocol was drafted and adopted. So thank you for coming. And then our third panelist is Dr. Steen Holger Hansen. He is the Deputy Chief Forensic Pathologist from the University of Copenhagen. In his daily life, he's working mostly in the Nordic countries, but he has a very active international career as well in documenting torture and other forms of ill treatment. He has been working with the ICTY in Kosovo. He's been working in the aftermath in Rwanda, also following the tsunami in Thailand. He has headed a team of specialists there, has been advising in Afghanistan and carrying out a number of documentations, also in collaboration with the IRCT, for example, in Cambodia. And he is a member of the International Forensic Expert Group, who is a roster of experts that are all very experienced in forensic medical documentation and provide technical advice as well as actual documentation expertise at a global level. So thank you. I will now first invite the Special Rapporteur for his statement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First, let me thank all of you for being here, because I think your presence in this side event signals the need for support for the work of forensic sciences and particularly forensic medicine in breaking the cycle of impunity for torture. And I think it's going to go a long way in making the Istanbul Protocol a much more useful tool than it is at this point. I also want to thank Miriam and the IRCT. The report that I presented yesterday to the Third Committee owes a lot to the support and advice and technical expertise that the IRCT and other colleagues of yours have provided me. And that support plus your willingness to host this side event with us is very much appreciated. I also want to thank the representatives of Denmark and Switzerland, not only for being here, but also for their unwavering support of the mandate over the years, before my time and during my time. It's highly appreciated as well. And I want to thank also the presence of a member of my own country, Argentina, today. And especially I want to appreciate and thank the possibility of sharing this panel with my friend Nigel Rodley and with Dr. Hansen. My report is public, so I won't read it. I'll summarize it. Just to give you a sense of why we thought it was necessary to use the opportunity of the report to the General Assembly to address this theme of the need for to promote more forensic evidence in the struggle against torture. And then I'll be eager to hear from Nigel and Dr. Hansen. The reason is that in the country visits and that we engage in, we find that forensic evidence of torture is sorely lacking almost everywhere. There's just not only very little support for complaints of torture based on medical evidence, but there's also, worse than that, a tendency to avoid doing forensic medical forensic examinations or to discard them when they, in the rare occasions in which they are present, which is particularly troublesome, especially because I think forensic science and medical sciences have made great progress in being able to detect torture and to provide sound, scientific, absolutely objective and irrebuttable evidence of the incidence of torture. So my main concern in addressing this topic is to try to promote the use of forensic sciences, and particularly the use of the high standards of the Istanbul Protocol in the struggle against torture worldwide. Because I think the finding the evidentiary basis for torture is crucial to all of the features of the Convention Against Torture. First and foremost, the obligation to investigate, prosecute, and punish every act of torture, which is very singularly a contribution of the Convention Against Torture, and I would argue also now customary international law. Together with the new Convention on Disappearances, these are the two phenomena, the two violations of human rights that elicit that obligation by the state to investigate, prosecute, and punish, even when there's a single episode and not necessarily when it is a pattern of crimes against humanity. But unfortunately, impunity for torture prevails in most countries around the world. And not the only one, certainly, but an important factor is the relative ease with which states can avoid this obligation by saying simply, we can't prove that torture has happened. And that's why I think forensic sciences are crucial to breaking the cycle of impunity. But there are other features of the Convention Against Torture that are also highly dependent on evidence, and particularly on forensic evidence. And I mean, for example, the exclusionary rule. We see case after case in which people are convicted on the basis of statements and confessions extracted under some form of coercion, usually torture, and the domestic jurisdictions very easily admit that evidence in spite of the prohibition in the convention by simply stating that it hasn't been proven that the confession was obtained under torture. And, of course, it's not proven if you don't want to try to prove it. And it seems to me, therefore, that the good faith application of the exclusionary rule depends a lot on the ability of states in good faith to to provide serious medical examinations and scientific evidence that torture has indeed occurred. And I think it's also crucial to the obligation to provide reparations and rehabilitation, because it is the medical examination that proves the extent and the scope of the pain and suffering that has been inflicted on the person, and that is essential as well to determine the level of reparations and rehabilitation. And of course, finally, the obligation to prevent torture would be highly assisted to states that want to prevent torture by having serious medical examinations and scientific evidence of the prevalence of torture. I think that's why in my report I insist mostly on safeguards, so that medical examinations not only take place, but they take place under conditions that the results are credible, objective, unassailable. Unfortunately, where they do take place, for the most part, they take place by services that are highly dependent on the supervision and control and even domination of the very agencies that have to be investigated for committing the torture. Medical services that are not independent from the police or even from the judiciary or the prosecutor's offices don't fulfill the need for independence and impartiality that is central to credible forensic evidence. But I also think safeguards would be important in order to make medical examinations routine. That is, for example, we need regulations at the state, at the domestic jurisdiction level, by which everybody who is arrested is brought before a doctor and have a medical examination without witnesses as soon as possible after apprehension. And also at every transfer from one detention center to another, so that there's no possibility that torture may happen in between those early stages, which is when torture generally happens. I think if interrogators and torturers knew that there was going to be a very prompt examination very soon after their interrogation, they would very likely be a lot more careful because they could be prosecuted for it. I think as a preventive measure, it's very important to build in the jurisdiction of each country safeguards by which medical examinations are not only encouraged, but that they are conducted in the most objective and serious way that they should be. I think the Protocol of Istanbul creates very high standards, and among them, the fact that the lack of physical evidence is not necessarily lack of evidence of torture, but it actually encourages psychiatric and psychological examination, as well as examination of the background, social and political background in which the allegation of torture takes place, because that is also germane to whether it's likely or more likely than not that the torture has actually taken place. So the fact that denunciations and complaints of torture are mostly made by people who are in the weakest of all possible positions to prove that they have been tortured requires an action by the state and even a legislative action to ensure that examinations take place whenever there's even a risk that torture has happened, even without a formal complaint by the potential victim. I also think that it's important for the Protocol of Istanbul not to be seized and apprehended or even appropriated by states. It's important for the medical profession, even from the private sector, to be trained in the Protocol of Istanbul, but it's even more important for the law to allow forensic evidence produced by private doctors to be allowed into evidence and not to be given any subordinate weight to the evidence produced by official, quote-unquote, medical services. One objection that I know we will hear from some states is that that some states really simply don't have resources to afford this kind of care. Of course, we want to encourage states to invest and to take seriously their obligations, even if it means investment in training, capacity building, etc. But we want to stress that there isn't anything highly technological or particularly expensive about conducting serious examinations and evidentiary exercises to prove torture. And also that there is the possibility of South-South cooperation and even and especially, and of course, also North-South cooperation. There are many organizations like IRCT, but also others that have quite a bit of expertise to share. And it's important for governments who have the wherewithal to support that sharing, but also for governments who claim not to have resources to avail themselves of this resource that consists of this kind of sharing of expertise. My final point is that we need not only to train more doctors, we do need that, but we also need to train lawyers, prosecutors, and judges in this, and especially on learning what kind of safeguards the Protocol of Istanbul requires in order for its their examinations to be credible, and what kind of evidence is available and should be made available in order to determine whether torture has occurred or not. If we succeed in all of this very ambitious agenda, I think we can foresee a torture-free world, maybe not in my lifetime, but in my grandchildren's lifetime. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your remarks. I'll now give the word to Sir Nigel Rodley. Thank you.
Thanks, Miriam. And thanks, Juan. Excuse me, I have a slow-burning virus that means I'm going to cough a little bit, and I'll do my best to try and keep it under control. It is a pleasure and a privilege to be here. As he said, Juan and I are friends, and I guess something of a mutual admiration society, so that which is quite nice between successor and predecessor. It's not always the case in any area. It's hard to add much to what Juan said, so most of what I'll say is in agreement with the Secretariat, and that perhaps I should say also a word of thanks to the Office of the High Commissioner. Thank you, Yael. A word of thanks to the High Commissioner, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Stephanie Selg, who helped organise this and gave me a bit of a steer. Thank you.
Sorry.
No, please. Can everybody hear me now, even if they couldn't before? Good, great. Because I haven't said very much so far. Other than to say that all I'm good for is reminiscence anyway in this area. It is a great initiative to promote the forensic scientists in general and the sciences in general and the Istanbul Protocol in particular. I hadn't realized how long it was. My own experience, and I'll start with that perhaps, was in fact in participation in the Istanbul meeting that adopted the Istanbul Protocol, including the Istanbul Principles. Juan has focused on the medical dimension of the forensic dimension of the protocol, but the principles accompanying the protocol were of a more general nature and as much juridical as forensic, but they include forensic elements. and they were a kind of torture follow-up to the principles on effective prevention and investigation of extralegal arbitrary and summary executions that had earlier been adopted by the General Assembly. So after its adoption, it was my privilege as Special Rapporteur to refer to the principles in my annual report, I think to the Commission, certainly to the Assembly, and suggested that the Assembly might wish to follow up with some endorsement parallel to that accompanied the principles on extralegal summary and arbitrary executions. Denmark, which was running the resolution even then, kindly took the suggestion up and presented it in its regular resolution, added it to the standard paragraphs, and even if the wording was a little bit more nuanced, they were effectively given a good housekeeping seal of approval by the General Assembly. And I was very pleased to have been able to play that role. I didn't use forensic assistance during any of the missions I took, except one, Romania, towards the end of my mandate. Partly I hadn't thought of it, nobody else thought of it either. And to some extent, and this will be a point we might want to go back to some extent I didn't see it as essential, because it wasn't my job to document this, that, or the other case as an absolute open and shut case of torture. That wasn't my function. My function was to see whether torture was happening, and one didn't need forensic medicine for that. It wouldn't do any harm. And in Romania, and there was a colleague from the IRCT based in Romania who did accompany the mission. It did certainly play a very helpful role. Digressing just a little bit, more recently, I found myself in a medical interview of alleged victims of torture as a member of a commission of inquiry set up by the government of Bahrain into alleged human rights violations in Bahrain, including torture allegations, and actually seeing a medical doctor doing the kind of interrogation of the person claiming to have been tortured, it would also have been a masterclass in any lawyer trying to do a similar job, avoiding leading cases and really permitting the story to come through and allowing the story to contradict itself if it was going to contradict itself. Lawyers seem to think that they're the only people who can spot contradictions. They're not. I didn't make major use of forensic medicine as Special Rapporteur, but I did see the need for forensic medicine, the value of forensic medicine, for all the reasons that Juan has already mentioned and are mentioned in his report, and I don't need to go back over that. Another thing I consistently did was, when I was Special Rapporteur, was make the point Juan has been making, that the officialization of the forensic medicine is already a potential problem if only the official testimony is permitted in forensic proceedings, legal proceedings, and not private medical testimony or privately commissioned medical testimony. And it's particularly bad in a situation where that service may be actually in the same hands as the law enforcement authority. This was the case in my last mission as Special Rapporteur in Brazil, where in all states, I think, the forensic service was in the hands of the police, the police services, I, needless to say, drew attention to it and made a recommendation that it should be changed. I don't know too much what may have happened in that respect, but I do know that a year or two later, I happened to be in the state of Pará, the state surrounding Belém at the mouth of the Amazon on a purely academic visit, and learned there that they had changed the system and put the medical service into the hands of the Justice Ministry in response to the report, which was encouraging, but that's just one of many states in Brazil, a federal state. Don't know what further developments there may have been. Excuse me. So that basically was my experience as rapporteur. I kind of based on the basis of that experience. I oversaw a project at my own university, the University of Essex, to develop a manual on the medical investigation and documentation of torture that didn't purport to be as advanced. It was done by a medical doctor. The main author was a medical doctor who was very familiar with applying the Istanbul principles. He worked for the what is now called Freedom from Torture. It used to be the Medical Foundation for the Care and Rehabilitation of Victims of Torture that... as Miriam said, I was a trustee of, and we felt it was necessary because even though it calls itself minimum, the Istanbul Protocol does require a fair amount of sophisticated expertise, which perhaps is not available, or at least at that time didn't seem available, in many, many countries of the world. We thought we would try and do a distillation of at least a minimum of credible practice that should be taken seriously, at least by the political and administrative authorities, if not necessarily by the courts. I mentioned freedom from torture. One of the issues I've come across recently, and the one dimension Juan hasn't mentioned where it's an important issue, at least in my country, and it may well be in others, is the issue of deportations. Many people are threatened with deportation to countries where they face torture, they face a very skeptical public administration that wants to get rid of them as undesirables for one reason or another. Very often, they require a high level of medical testimony, corroborative medical testimony, before they're prepared to believe that a particular individual who threatens to be at risk and claims to already have been a victim, to demonstrate that he or she has already been a victim. It's been particularly frustrating to find that when the Medical Foundation, the Freedom from Torture organization, produces a report based on a whole range of testimony, but inevitably anonymized, the authorities try and trash it on the grounds that they're not able to investigate the individual cases. And I must say, I suspect we may not be the only jurisdiction where it's a problem, but I'm not very proud to be of the fact that it has been a problem. Finally, I'll conclude with this, the Human Rights Committee, which I'm chairing at the moment, has been referring to the Istanbul Principles quite a lot. In anticipation of this, Stephanie's colleagues in the Treaty Division were kind enough to get some information to me. We seem to make a pretty good habit of drawing attention to the Istanbul Principles when encouraging states to investigate torture effectively. We did it in four cases in 2010, in two in 2011, in two in 2012, then in 10 in 2013. I haven't a clue what to make of that graph, other than the fact that it's seems to be going in a more sustained direction, and that is that has to be a good thing. It's always useful to be able to draw states' attention to standards of whatever that they themselves have more or less given an assent to, given a nod to, and that's true of the Istanbul principles. So sorry to have gone on for so long. Let me stop there and look forward to the further discussion.
Thank you for your remarks. It's very encouraging to hear about, you know, the progress that the Istanbul Protocol has made since its inception and the wider acceptance, and that you know, it's found its way around the world. I will now give the word to Dr. Steen Holger Hansen, and also it was mentioned by both speakers the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration, that it's not only about the prosecutors and judges or the prison authorities, it's also about health professionals. So I'm particularly pleased that we have a interdisciplinary panel here today, and we'll also hear from the forensic medical side and from somebody that is actually doing the work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great honor to be on this panel. After hearing the very interesting subject about forensic medicine and for the Istanbul Protocol, I will approach the subject in a more practical way, because I'm used to work with this Istanbul Protocol, and I am a forensic pathologist and I work with forensic medicine. I have a short presentation, and there will be very few pictures, and there's not pictures you not can watch, I would say, but right away. The definition of forensic medicine actually is a branch of medicine. We are all doctors. We deal with legal implication of health care and determines and interpret causes of disease, injury, and death. And, of course, it's the two last thing that's most important in these cases. As doctors, we do not perform any kind of treatment, but of course we have cases where we can give recommendations. And this is actually the Istanbul Protocol, how it looks. I have been working with this protocol for about 10 years. It's a manual, it's a great tool. You can build a mission on this. And it's from the very first day to the day you deliver the report. So I can strongly recommend the use of the Istanbul Protocol. But there are so many things about forensics general society are not aware of. And I have some principles here I would like to present. In any forensic examinations, we start with a story. We have some attribution given by the victims or witnesses. What happened? How did it happen? When did it happen? And then we go in as doctors and do the clinical findings. We do the documentation. After that, we have to do the interpretation of these findings. And finally, we express the consistency between these attributions and the findings. It is very important to understand that as a forensic pathologist, you should never say, this man has been tortured. This is not our work. This is work for the judge. But we can say, oh, these findings we have, these are not consistent with the story we are told. It could be consistent. It could be highly consistent. That would say it could have been caused by what we have heard. There could be a few other possibilities. And sometimes we can say, this is typical of. This is the usual findings when we examine victims of these kind of traumas. That's very important, the consistency. When we do the documentation, in this case we talk about survivors, it's very important this examination have two legs. It's a clinical forensic examination, but just as important is the psychological examination. As we all know, physical torture can give physical evidence, physical scars, but the psychological scars is probably the worst problem in many cases when they come to the unfortunate case where people don't survive, of course, the examination is the autopsy, and we had to work in another way. We don't actually have the story from the victim, but from witnesses. Documentation can be done very inexpensive. You need a ruler, a scale, so you can photograph, take pictures of what you see of lesions. You have to have a camera. You have to draw some sketches. And if you do this properly, you can always have a colleague, a trained forensic pathologist, actually to help you doing the conclusion of this examination. So this is very inexpensive. And about the context of investigation, yeah, we all like your very good conditions with a separate room for every examined person. And if we need a CT scan or MRI scan, we like to have that too. And in the best of all worlds, we will have that. But this is not yet so far. I hope it will be. But when you go on missions, you have some other issues, some other problems. Sometimes you don't even have a table. Other cases, we have a table, and in the last one, we have a bed and a table and a roof too, and that was a very good place to do the examinations. But still, the principles are the same. We had to do it in a private place where no other can attend or interfere with the examination. We had this forensic evidence in the Fight Against Torture project, and there was a collaboration between the IRCT and our Department of Forensic Medicine in Copenhagen. And we performed a fact-finding mission in June 2011 in Cambodia. The aim of this mission was to examine survivors of the Pol Pot regime, and that was in 75 to 79, for the extraordinary court of the chamber of the Cambodian court. And we did 11 examinations of survivors. And first of all, it was 6 women and 5 men. But as you see, the ages differed from 57 years to 68 years. And that is generally much older than the survivors we normally examine. But in this case, that was an obvious reason that has been more than 30 years since the ill treatment. And what did they report? What was the substance in their history? Yeah, that was forced labor, deportation, forced marriage, imprisonment, no access to medical care, and some also reported torture and ill treatment. I did these examinations with a forensic psychiatrist who examined, and we all know that torture can cause a wide range of physical but also psychological suffering. And the main psychiatric disorders associated with torture are the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress syndrome, and in many cases, depression. And my colleagues found that all of the victims in some degree expressed depression, re-experiencing the traumatic events, avoidance, hyperarousal, and many had somatic complaints too. So they concluded that all 11 survivors had exposed to traumatic events, had psychological findings as seen in PTSD, and the findings were found to be highly consistent with the attribution given by the survivors. With the physical examination, this is what you can call a cold case. And I can strongly emphasize it is very, as soon as possible it's, you can make the examination, the better is the results. But sometimes there are many obstacles and sometimes many years pass, weeks, months, and sometimes years pass until you can do the examination. And we know all that even in cases of severe torture and ill treatment, the clinical findings, scars on the body, are often sparse, if there are any. And when you think about the atrocities in Cambodia that took place more than 30 years ago, so from the start, I find the chances to demonstrate any physical signs seemed very small. After the examination, I they reported different kind of torture. And it's very important to remember that it's very rarely just one thing people are exposed to. It's a broad scale of ill-treatment. Forced labor, beating, kicking, legs shackled in cuffs, burned with hot metal, blindfolded, rape. And I had a little help from Van Natt. He was one of the very few survivors of the Tuol Sleng prison in Phnom Penh, and he painted the atrocities after he was released. As you can see, this is a shackle, leg shackle, and the man here, he has a shackle, and in close range, you can almost see he has a wound at that time. So I could even examine these shackles often used in Cambodia at that time. And when I did the examination of the survivors, four of them have a scar placed exactly that place. This is not a proof. It could never be a proof, but that strongly suggests that that could be the case. And when it comes to arms tied on the back, they all told me they had the arms tied in a very special way, not around the wrists, but around the elbows. And it was very tight. And at the museum, at the killing fields, I saw some of these very strong cotton strings that have been used. And doing the examination, you actually were able to see some very specific scars. None of them knew they had them. They couldn't remember. They could remember the wounds, but they didn't have ever see this scar, and you had to look very thorough. Two of the persons explained that if they didn't work fast enough, they were poked in the back with a hot metal rod, and exactly that place, they had these scars. Again, it's not a proof, but that is consistent. So my findings was 6 out of 7 survivors reporting have their arms tied on the back had actually a transverse scar. 4 of the 5 survivors reporting have their legs shackled up had actually a scar about 10 centimeters above the ankle. And both survivors, been poked with this hot rod, had a scar on the back. So the overall conclusion is all 11 survivors had psychological findings and to some extent physical findings highly consistent with the traumatic events reported. So lesson learned from this fact-finding mission, it seems to be possible to document torture and ill-treatment even more than 30 years after the traumatic events. And the main lesson, even if the chances for a positive outcome seems rather small, examination should never be omitted just because of the time passed. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for this very interesting presentation. I'm sure we'll have a few more questions for you afterwards. Allow me just to break with my own role as moderator for just a second, because I realized there was also a comment from both the special rapporteur and the representative of Denmark on the work the organization I'm working with is doing. I work with the International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims, which has its seat in Denmark. We are a global network of rehabilitation centers that provide services for torture survivors. We currently have about 150 member centers in over 70 countries, and all of them provide at least health treatment. Many of them provide support in the medical documentation of torture, and many also are engaged in the broader human rights work. We've been working and promoting the Istanbul Protocol throughout the drafting stages and then the implementation, so have a number of other organizations. And we have recently formed a group together with Physicians for Human Rights, Redress, and Human Rights Foundation Turkey to exchange our experience in implementing the Istanbul Protocol. And what became very clear is that it's not about only doing one activity, and this is, I think, what all the panelists also have been saying, but that it is important to approach the implementation of proper investigation and documentation from a more systematic point of view. So there need to be a few preconditions to even properly carry out medical documentations. There needs to be a system in place that allows these reports to be drafted in an independent manner, as was stressed by the special rapporteur, and be brought forward, that victims themselves have access to the reports and own the reports, and that they are used in a proper way in the investigation. So what this group of organizations is currently working on is to create the so-called Istanbul Protocol Plan of Action. It's an initiative to provide guidance on how to implement the Istanbul Protocol in a broader way and to construct the right framework for its implementation. It contains, the initiative contains basically three elements. One is the outline of the broader basic principles. The second one is a set of activities, kind of a roadmap, step-by-step guide on the broader implementation issues that have to be taken into consideration, including the preconditions, guidance for health professionals, their role in documenting, but also in not participating in torture and caring for the survivors, the criminal justice system, and also very importantly, as was said also before, the monitoring and accountability elements. Plus, of course, the idea is to provide resources fitting for the different stakeholders involved in the investigation and documentation of torture, be it the security forces, health professionals, detention authorities, other government agencies, civil society. I thank the Special Rapporteur for making reference to this initiative in your report. We'll be driving this forward and hopefully we'll get some good guidance out of that in the very near future. Thank you. Now, having said that, I will go back to my moderating role. And I think, thank you, it's been, there have been very complimentary presentations. And one thing I think that was raised quite a bit was the need for forensic expertise, but at the same time, the apparent lack of it. And maybe I would like to start with asking Dr. Hansen, why do you think there are not more of you that...
In general, forensic medicine is a very small specialty, and I know it's not in all countries they have a special. They have their own specialty. We have in Denmark, so you had to approach this subject from another point of view, and you had to be special interested in these cases. Well, probably that's not that much money. Many doctors like to earn money, so that's probably another issue. It's not a very sexy specialty. But given that, I find, and we have heard about it, learned about it, many colleagues are very interested in these forensic problems, and especially in human rights. We have a large group in Denmark of people interested in human rights. So, of course, the possibility is there. And the main subject is training, education, training all the time. Young people, they want training. And if you give them that, then I think it could grow to a larger population of doctors interested in these things. That's from my point of view in Denmark.
Thank you, Professor Mendes. You've mentioned the importance of independence, and maybe you could elaborate a little bit more on how you see, or where you see the biggest challenges, or how you see the protection of the independence of the forensic expertise.
Well, certainly, in most countries, the first and perhaps only medical examination is done by police service, police doctors, and they are thoroughly under the control of doctors. They see themselves much more as policemen than as doctors, and they will very seldom, if ever, document violations of torture because they have this misunderstood esprit de corps that they will not, rat on their fellow policemen. And I suppose better systems include putting those services under the judiciary, either as a central agency within the judiciary of the country, or as services to more local, more regional, or more district courts. but I think in those cases also there tends to be an attitude of protecting the institution, of not rocking the boat too much, not forcing the issue of documentation because... Unfortunately, judges and courts also don't want to hear about it. Don't want to hear about torture because it just complicates the resolution of cases, etc. I think obviously medical services under prosecutorial services also suffer from the same problems. My friend Dr. Duarte Nuno Vieira, who almost always travels with me in our missions. Says that the best solution is for the health ministry, the public health ministry, to be in charge of all of these services. And I assume that that's the better solution, although quite frankly we've also seen some examples in which doctors who nominally at least report to the health ministry are in fact so close to the police and the prosecutorial services that in fact they're not independent enough. But that's the same problem, I think, with the independence of courts. I mean, there are clear criteria for independence, but we need to concentrate both on the objective, that is the formal criteria of independence, but also on the subjective one. And we need to encourage professionals to be independent and answered only to their own conscience and their own scientific knowledge. That is something that is not impossible, but it does take a lot of work, and it takes a lot, especially I think, of peer pressure. I mean, all professionals want to be respected in their profession, and it's important to tell them that they have to earn that respect.
I agree.
That's very good, yeah.
I agree too. I can say in Denmark,
forensic medicine is not placed under the juridical system and neither on the health system, but we are at the university system, the education system. So we are not dependent on neither of the two other systems. We have been that for 100 years.
And just very briefly, that sounds about as good as it gets, and I guess when I'm not going to expect, and Juan isn't going to expect that to be duplicated in too many other places. And just to recall that in the end, there are no institutionally secure solutions without the last bit that Juan mentioned, the integrity, the conscience, the ontology. It's not going to happen regardless as to where they're put. Obviously, where they're put may make it easier for them to act conscientiously, professionally, ethically. But it's not a. It helps, but it won't assure it. All that will assure it is, in the end, exactly what Juan said, the element of consciousness, and pride. And I think peer pressure is important, not just for medics, but also for judges. I have very little doubt, for example, that the use of language like black holes, that the senior British judiciary used to describe what was going on at Guantanamo in the first 5 years of the noughties, had something to do with the US Supreme Court deciding in the Hamdan case that certiorari and then later habeas corpus could apply even in Guantanamo. That element of peer pressure is extremely important.
Thank you. I'm just looking at the watch. We have about 15 minutes left. I just wonder, are there any questions from the audience at this point? Yes, please. Sorry. Could I ask you to please just state your name and organization?
It's not, do you see it? Oh, yeah. Hi. I'm Dr. Yael Danieli. I've been around this for too many years. And another way of making professionals independent or dependent on their peer pressure is, and I don't know where it is in the report, I didn't have a chance to look at it, is professional organizations and licensing practices in the professions to make sure that they follow ethical practices. And Miriam, part of the answer to your question, why there are so few, it's not just a matter of money. It's very hard to do. It's very hard to listen to people who have undergone great suffering, particularly in the hands of other people. I mean, what humanity does to its own. So I think we should acknowledge that. And not only in terms of formal education, but support for the professionals who are doing the work. You know, steady support. So not just ethical principles, but steady support for them that should be provided as part of the process. I have some bad news in terms of long-term effects. I mean, we have now, we've accumulated through the years evidence that people develop cancer and die prematurely because of torture and because of human rights violations. So, for example, we know that, I don't want to give a lecture, but we have a great deal of knowledge along those lines. And I'm wondering how much of within the concept is the inclusion of the family of the survivor, particularly the children, because there are effects, of course, of these all the human rights violations on the next generation as well. And we do have the knowledge to provide and to back, the body of knowledge that you're talking about. So 30 years is not very long, certainly not for psychological. We even have epigenetic results now that show that it goes from generation to generation. So we have to think of it long-term, lifelong and multi-generational. By the way, from a psychological point, while from a physical point of view, it's best to examine as soon as possible from a psychological point of view, we need the long-term, actually, to establish the effect. So it's a little more complicated always. That's all.
Thank you very much. It's a very important comment to look at it in the broader perspective, to include the next of kin, the community, because that's where the impact also is, and that's where we need to also document and as you also say, focus our efforts of supporting survivors, of reaching out with regard to rehabilitation. And I believe that's done in many places. And I think it also goes back to a very important point when we talk about the examination of torture survivors, that is essentially it is about a person, and there needs to be an understanding and consent about the examination taking place and the and the information being shared and properly recorded. Do you have a... Yeah, exactly, I'm protected.
Well, my report was not meant to be a, you know, kind of an explanation or a glossary of the Protocol of Istanbul, because it is itself an important document. It was more about how to promote implementation of it and implementation in good faith. So my understanding is that the protocol does include the next of kin in the need for examination. And, of course, international law generally and our rapporteurship as well have long said that victims are not only the direct victims but also the relatives. And so to the extent, especially for purposes of reparations and rehabilitation, it is important to examine the psychological effects of torture, not only on the direct victim, but also on the next of kin. That also should be subject to the high standards of the Istanbul Protocol.
First of all, to congratulate both Professor Juan Mendez and Sir Nigel Rodley for all the work that they have done, particularly in Mexico, the country of which I am original. And my question would be if they know more or less like a number of states that are applying right now the Istanbul Protocol. I understand that this is not a protocol to the convention, but it's an apart document, so I know that there's not like a number of ratifications to this protocol, but rather it's applied directly by political will of states. I just want to know if there's a more or less number. Thank you so much.
I am not aware of a statistic about that. My first impression is that in many countries that I've visited, they don't even know about it or not know enough about it. That some doctors know about it, but when you ask them, do you apply it, they say, no, we don't have the resources, etc. I would make an exception with Mexico, because in Mexico, all of a sudden, everybody talks about the Protocol of Istanbul. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows it. Everybody, they claim to know it. And especially the civil society organizations, they're very keen on it. And there's a lot of training going around. You have to wonder, however, whether it's applied well. For example, in some of the federated states, they rely on the national authorities to provide them with implementation of the Protocol of Istanbul, and the national Commission on Human Rights is completely overwhelmed. They come 6 months later to do a medical examination, if they come. And so there are some states that have their own state commissions and that have forensic services, and some of them with well-trained doctors. I would especially mention the Federal District Institution of Human Rights for that. But there are several states in the interior of Mexico that don't have any training or any capacity. They know about it and they ask the federal authorities for help on it, but they don't really know it. And there is a tendency to use the protocol as sort of a mantra, you know. Everybody says, we did it with Protocol of Istanbul and we proved that there was torture. Mostly the NGOs say that. And then the state says, we applied the Protocol of Istanbul and we demonstrated that there was no torture. So you have to ask yourself, you know, well, tell us how you did it rather than just citing the protocol. And there I suspect that there's some, differences of intensity of the application of the protocol and even of good faith application.
Well, I think I know even less than Juan these days, other than to point out that, of course, the protocol may be in use without necessarily having been, as it were, adopted by the state. The forensic medical profession may have adopted it. The judiciary may have become influenced by it, as certainly has been the case in the United Kingdom, almost a little bit too dependent on it, and then they want doctors to certify the highest level of absolute possible consistency such that practically no other explanation is possible before they're prepared to then go along with the finding when, of course, doctors, as you've already seen from Dr. Augustine, have to be a little bit more careful than that, which doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't a serious problem. I'm moving away from the question, I'm sorry. But it does raise another point that I think ought to be made, and it relates to something Juan said earlier, and that is the role of medical evidence in forensic proceedings. Obviously, if you're trying to bring a criminal case against somebody, then you need a very high standard of proof. On the other hand, if you're talking about whether or not the individual's statement made in court, self-incriminatory statement, is one that was made freely and without coercion, then a rather different level of proof should be necessary. And indeed, the burden should not even be on the individual to prove that he or she was tortured. The burden should be on the state, which has the individual at his or her mercy, to be able to demonstrate that the individual was in fact properly treated as opposed to ill-treated. And you don't need medical evidence, or rather you shouldn't need medical evidence if the state takes that that burden seriously. And so it's just the point I thought needed making. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a very brief comment. I'm Renzo Pomi with Amnesty International. I'm here with colleagues from Amnesty Denmark, Amnesty Malaysia, from the International Secretariat. And we are very happy to be here and very happy to be co-sponsors of this event. We want to thank the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights, the states who are co-sponsoring this. We highly value the leadership of Denmark on torture issues, and we have been working very, very closely with them on the resolution every year, until last year, and we will be happy to work with them next year as well. And of course, we value the leadership of Switzerland on many human rights and international law and humanitarian law issues. And we are delighted to be here with this excellent panel. As I said yesterday in a different panel, we hope that our efforts on torture are complementary with the efforts by Denmark and other countries and the efforts that you and the panel also have. Just a brief comment on at the beginning, the moderator said that this was the year of the 30th anniversary of the convention, but also a special anniversary of the protocol. But also next year in September is the 30th anniversary of the Inter-American Convention for the Prevention and Punishment of Torture. And because of that reason, we worked with several countries in the Americas region to adopt a resolution last year, which was the first OAS resolution on torture, which, by the way, mirrors the torture resolution of the UN and also refers to the importance of following the Istanbul principles on the investigation of torture. So we hope that this series of anniversaries can build a momentum to work for the prevention of torture and also for the investigation and punishment of when it happens. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Obviously very important work that Amnesty is doing with your campaign and with all your efforts. I wanted to follow up on one thing that you both were actually mentioning about the application of the Istanbul Protocol and maybe also the limitations on that, to see that obviously it can also be used in a way that is putting more limitations or actually providing a limiting a framework to conducting proper investigations, to say that the standards are too high or that too high requirements are put on the evaluation of the protocol. I don't know if you would like to elaborate a bit more on that.
I think I probably already said it at this stage. Just about everything one can think of that can help can also be turned around and used against. So that there's no magic bullet here. And I do take the lawyer's position, if you'll forgive me, of insisting that burdens of proof shouldn't be such that the Istanbul Protocol be seriously needed other than as evidence in criminal proceedings against the perpetrator. Of course it is, and it will be, and it will continue to be. We can't deny somebody wanting to avoid deportation the wish for a medical forensic expertise that is based on the Istanbul Protocol. And, of course, it's there, and it's an international standard, and it's accepted, and that's important too. Trying to avoid, just as over the years I've tried to counsel against the over-medicalization of torture as a disease, I also want to counsel against the over-medicalization of evidence in relation to various kinds of needs to address the problem of torture. Thank you.
Yeah, in our reports and even in this report, we also mentioned the shift on the burden of evidence that that Nigel mentioned, because it is important for the state to bear the burden of proving that all the evidence that is going to be used against any defendant has been obtained free of coercion. In fact, the reverse seems to be the case in most countries that we visited. It's very frequent that evidence is admitted because they claim it hasn't been proven that it was obtained under torture. And I think the perverse use, if there is one, of the protocol is that there tends to be a dismissal of forensic evidence after medical examination because it didn't check every box in the protocol. And so, for example, the examinations conducted under circumstances like the photographs that Dr. Hansen showed us are sometimes, in bad faith, of course, dismissed as not consistent with the protocol because it, somehow doesn't reach the standard. But I think it's the good faith interpretation of the protocol would show that there are some essential aspects of the medical examination that have to be in place. But they're not dependent on the facilities or on the machinery that you can use, the equipment, etc. They're dependent on rigorous, objective, ethically defensible practices by doctors. But I think that's a battle that we'll have to wage in specific cases because it's. It's impossible to say as a matter of a rule that, even if you can't fill half of the requirements of the Istanbul Protocol, you still have to accept the findings of the doctor. It will depend on the conditions in which it was done. So one important aspect of the protocol that says that the victim should be given a copy of the results is... observed in the breach, even in countries that claim to to apply the protocol. If that's the case, even if it was done with high scientific rigor, the victim of torture still denied the possibility of challenging the methodology and the results of the examination. So I think we need to insist on the protocol and also insist on the good faith interpretation of what the protocol requires.
Thank you very much. I am afraid we are nearing the end, having a look at the time. But I would like to give our panelists and maybe also the representatives of Denmark and Switzerland the possibility for a quick last statement, maybe on what you see as the main priority for the way forward.
In which order?
Oh, maybe we'll start on... At this end.
Well, actually, thank you very much. I did not prepare a final statement, but it really has been an extremely interesting side event, and we were happy that we were here able to sponsor this with our Swiss and Amnesty International friends. It's good. I mean, our focus, of course, is, as our colleague from Amnesty International mentioned, the work that so many countries put into the resolution now every second year here in New York. We are happy that the initiative we took with a number of other countries in staging an initiative for the convention is really going well, and we see more and more countries. And we also know, and that's it. It has been so good to hear today also that, you know, bringing in the knowledge and the actual experiences from the work that the special rapporteur and doctors such as Dr. Hansen brings in, you know, important evidence that we can share and that can be used in the sometimes rather lofty discussions that we have here in New York, where we really need this kind of evidence for bringing forward the work of the fight against torture. So for us, it has been very, very good to have you all here, and thank you for attending. Thank you.
Well, I can just say thank you, and again, education, training of forensic, not only doctors, nurses, and other people. We can actually have quite good, very good forensic nurses doing the documentation and working on the awareness of the Istanbul Protocol everywhere we come. But I would say, as Mendes also said, it's not many places that actually know this protocol, only by a few doctors. So we have to advertise the protocol.
Well, and you can count on the rapporteurship to disseminate and to advertise the protocol as much as we can. But also I'd like to count on all of you to bring to our attention ways in which we can do it and especially opportunities for capacity building and training. We are very keen on promoting the protocol and promoting effective use of it. So I'd like to thank again all of you for being here, and particularly, since I didn't say it before, I want to thank my friend Renzo and Amnesty International for being here and for supporting and convening with us this meeting. But also wish Amnesty success in the campaign against torture that it is again launching this year, is it, or next? Yeah. And offer whatever I can do from the rapporteurship to help on that campaign.
Thank you.
Well, maybe I'll take off from there too. I first got involved in this area as the first legal advisor of Amnesty International. So it's very nice to see Amnesty International still in there slugging. I started the same year, 1973, as the first campaign against torture was launched. And I got most of my expertise, such as it is, in that office. And I guess I'm probably the only one here. I kept noticing the convention initiative, which, of course, I'm delighted to endorse. I'm probably the only one here that may well have been involved on behalf of Amnesty in most of the process of drafting the torture convention, which the idea that it's already 30 years ago that it was adopted is rather chastening, I have to say. We thought then that it would be easier to get ratifications for the torture convention than it was for the covenant. It took a long time. It took 10 years for the covenant just to get 35 on civil and political rights, just to get 35 ratifications. And yet in the end, the torture convention ratification rate never quite caught up with that of the covenants, which was surprising, if only because of its narrower focus and the fact that torture is illegal in virtually every country of the world. So I'm glad the campaign to get universal ratification is going. I'm glad Amnesty is still very much a part of that struggle and the general struggle against torture. It's somehow coming full circle for me. And so I was very pleased also to see that Amnesty was a co-sponsor of this meeting. Thanks.
Thank you. Please. Great. Okay. Well, then... yes, well, then it just leaves me to thank the panelists, to thank the governments of Switzerland and Denmark for your support, to thank all the other co-sponsors to this event, Amnesty, the Washington College of Law of the American University, and the Office of the High Commissioner, and not least, of course, you, the audience. Thank you very much for your engagement and your interest in the subject and for staying with us despite the fact that we went a little bit of overtime. I find that's a very good sign. Thank you and have a very good day.